Support for Science Questions comes from USU's College of Science, advancing the educational experience of future scientists with advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Science Questions. I'm Susie Montgomery.
And I'm Sherry Quinn.
Today on the program, SQ Radio intern Amanda Foste introduces us to the brand new 203,000 square foot molecular biotechnology lab on the U of U campus, where interdisciplinary research teams will collaborate to advance big areas in science like nanotechnology, renewable energy, early disease detection, and geochemistry.
Then we go north to Utah State University in Logan and profile a USTAR and USU Energy Dynamics lab project called Intuitive Building, where engineers are developing software and devices to essentially decode an office room scene in order to light it, based on the occupant's daily patterns and preferences. The wave of the future.
Michael O'Malley, and that's M-I-C-H-A-E-L, last name capital O, apostrophe capital M-A-L-L-E-Y, and I am the marketing director for USTAR, which is the Utah Science Technology and Research Initiative.
And can you tell us a little bit about this building and what's going to be happening here and what that's going to do for the state of Utah?
We're sitting here in the James L. Sorensen Molecular Biotechnology Building on the University of Utah campus. And this is a brand new research facility. It's a multidisciplinary research facility, meaning it's not just one department. It's a variety of researchers working on a variety of large problems, and they're interacting every day in this facility. It's 208,000 square feet. It includes a 23,000 square foot nanofabrication and microscopy unit. Having those co-located together is really, really convenient for the researchers, very efficient for them to conduct nanomaterial science and then looking at what they've created in these scanning electron microscopes. In the Sorensen Building, we have the Nano Institute of Utah, we have the Brain Institute, and we have a significant number of faculty from the Department of Bioengineering. So that's an example of just how diverse the faculty, the researchers in this building are. And I liken it to kind of the Reese's Cup. When you, they talk about, gee, you got peanut butter on my chocolate. No, you got chocolate on my peanut butter, and next thing you know, you have a Reese's cup. When you have these brilliant minds in different disciplines interacting every day in the atrium, in the cafe space, in the meeting rooms, outdoors in the seating areas, that accidental interaction is what creates new collaborations and new ideas and ultimately new breakthroughs. So there are a lot of intentional design features in this building that promote accidental interactions between these researchers and with the industry people who will come in here as well. So there was a lot of thought going into how do you create a space that's a great working environment, not just from a pleasant place to work with a great view, but also how do you incorporate that mixing of talent that's in this building. USTAR has already had a significant impact on the economy of Utah. First of all, these rock star researchers that we've recruited have brought in hundreds of millions of dollars of research grants over the last 5 years into the state. That's important because for every $1 million of research funding that comes in from out of state, that represents about 20 new jobs. So research means jobs, and it's important for the public to know that and to support the science that's going on at the U of U and at Utah State University and our other higher ed institutions, because it has a direct impact on our economy. It also diversifies our economy, and that helps us weather economic downturns. I think the state of Utah is coming out of the current downturn in better shape than a lot of states because of the diversity and depth of its high technology industries. The other impact that USTAR has is the creation of new companies. Between the two research universities and our regional outreach offices, we've helped more than 40 new companies start or relocate to Utah. And we have plans to create more than 200 over the lifespan of USTAR. Over that same time, in the 5 years that we've been around, our regional outreach offices have helped startup entrepreneurs secure more than $42 million of private investment from the private sector. So the business world likes what it sees in USTAR and has responded accordingly.
It seems like the changes that are being made in the dynamics are really awesome and are going to make some awesome changes. What was it like before? Did those departments really interact very much? Or
when USTAR was put in place 5 years ago, one of the guiding principles that our governing authority put in place was the multidisciplinary nature of the entire initiative. They deliberately sought out faculty researchers who in different focus areas, but then made sure that they were interacting. And I think what happens at some research universities is that research becomes siloed. And USTAR at the University of Utah and Utah State University is deliberately trying to intermix disciplines. So it's a deliberate strategy, and we think that it pays off in the long run with more fruitful interaction between these brilliant people that we brought to the state. The other thing to bear in mind is I've heard Tom Parks, the VP for research at the University, describe what's happening nationally in terms of large grants as being an arms race, that the bigger, more complex federal research grants are going to those cross-disciplinary teams of researchers. And so for the University of Utah and Utah State, which has a similar building, the USTAR Bio Innovation Center, which opened a year ago, for these two research universities to have built-in cross-functional teams and the infrastructure that these buildings represent to back those teams, it puts both of our research universities in a far more competitive position to go after those large federal grants. We've heard directly from any number of our USTAR faculty and other faculty at the two universities, their affiliated faculty, that the USTAR initiative has helped break down barriers and helped increase collaboration and allowed a variety of researchers to go after bigger problems in a meaningful way.
Thanks, Michael O'Malley and Amanda Fosty. Living things, from cyanobacteria to plants, animals, and humans, have a circadian rhythm, a 24-hour internal clock that is regulated by light. For humans, the circadian mechanism is mainly located in the brain's hypothalamus, an area intimately linked to our nervous system, roughly the size of an almond, that controls body temperature, hunger, thirst, fatigue, and our sleep cycle. Disruptions, such as jet lag or shift work, generally have a negative effect on our behavior and also have long-term health consequences, including cardiovascular disease. Medications like Ambien and supplements like melatonin, used to treat circadian rhythm disorders and insomnia, have a lot of serious side effects. Engineers at the Utah State University Energy Dynamics Laboratory are literally shining an energy-efficient light on us, calibrating our clock genes, minimizing the effects of circadian disruptions, and perhaps even serving up an enticing proxy to the 3 o'clock coffee run. Air traffic controllers on shift work are experiencing sleep disorders and reportedly falling asleep on the job, a major safety concern for the Federal Aviation Association, or the FAA, who are currently adjusting shift work policies to ensure their workers stay awake and safely land planes. Lauren Fowler, professor of psychology at Weber State University, is studying the effects of shift work on behavior and health. Air traffic controllers are just one group of many vulnerable to the side effects of erratic work schedules.
It's very, very dangerous, and especially when you look at the number of people who work shift work in the military and in law enforcement and medical fields.
Staying awake through the night causes a multitude of problems, including cancer. In fact, the World Health Organization calls shift work a carcinogenic behavior.
It's not healthy, and you see reproductive problems, you see increases in gastrointestinal cancers. Basically, anytime you disrupt melatonin, which is a sleep hormone, you're going to see some pretty widespread effects.
Rob Strupp is a 30-year-old nurse in the psychiatric unit at the University of Utah Hospital in Salt Lake City. He volleys between day and night shifts. Strupp says he suffers the most around 3 a.m., and caffeine does not help.
You can try and sleep all you want, you know, the day before the shift, but I don't know how other people do it, but me, it doesn't matter how much I slept before that shift, I'm still going to get tired between the hours of 3 a.m. to 7 a.m., like, no matter what.
And then Strupp still needs to drive home after being awake all night.
I've seen the accidents. I've almost been in accidents driving home, and it's not safe. It's dangerous.
So basically, after one day of being awake, your performance, your cognitive performance, is virtually the same as being legally drunk.
I've seen nurses mess up on giving the wrong medications, antibiotics at the wrong times. Unfortunately, I think sometimes the corporate world overrules safety. Money overrules safety.
And in some instances, money-making ventures and safety go hand in hand.
I am a researcher at heart, so I like to constantly invent new things.
That was Dr. Dasu Aravind, the director of an engineering team at the Utah State University Energy Dynamics Laboratory, EDL, developing lighting technology for homes and buildings across America, not only to increase energy efficiency, but also human productivity in the workplace.
The common part amongst all buildings, irrespective of the purpose, is energy consumption. So lighting controls today is an $800 million market, but less than 1% penetration. So the growth opportunity is phenomenal over here.
The ancillary is that this corporate venture will help shift workers like Strupp stay alert on the job and drive home safely.
This lighting technology, what they call an anticipatory and intuitive system, is based on smart occupancy sensors, tiny high-tech sensors embedded in the ceilings. An office space, for instance, will collect intelligence about occupant habits and routine and serve to determine the perfect lighting in order to optimize the occupant's alertness and ultimately their productivity. U-Star researcher and project director, Dr. Aravind Dasu.
So the idea being that when people come into their offices, lights go on, but if you sit, you know, quietly working on the computer or some other sedentary kind of stuff, then it shouldn't go off on you. You shouldn't have to wave your hands and all that stuff. The software and the hardware technology which we have created basically mitigates that problem. You don't have the hand-waving stuff anymore.
From psychologist Lauren Fowler's point of view, although people may want to keep control of their light switches, that might not be in their best interest. This intelligence is designed to make us happier, more keen, alert, awake, and of course, more productive all day long at work. What could be better? Fowler is addressing these Orwellian fears, working with Dasu and team to understand more intricately how certain hues can play and accentuate our mood, behavior, and biology.
They'll say, well, we want to do an algorithm for this. I'll say, okay, well, now if you do this, it will affect humans this way. Or if you put them in this type of situation, people are going to get creeped out. And so I try to take the human package and put it into the building that they're talking about. And we have been doing studies piecemeal to say, okay, if we make the light come on automatically, does that bother people? And sometimes it does. Sometimes people don't like that, knowing that this light is going to come on automatically. So we study, is it better for performance, but is it worse for perception and happiness?
The science of what makes us tick under what circumstances literally starts at the cellular level. A 2009 study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences online journal says that when chemotherapy damages DNA, the cell's ability to repair damage was at a minimum in the early morning and reached a maximum in the evening hours. Timing is everything. Every single cell in the body has its own internal clock, and each one is synchronized by a master clock located in a cluster of neurons in the brain.
We know there are different brain parts that are responsible for driving the circadian rhythm. There's a part of our brain called the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is responsible for guiding, kind of driving all of the other rhythms. So if you can imagine, you have a rhythm of thirst and a rhythm of hunger and a rhythm of visual acuity and oxygen intake and absorption and body temperature and sleep-wake. And those are all different rhythms that are synchronized by our suprachiasmatic nucleus. So it's a part of our hypothalamus that kind of helps govern us. And in birds, it's similar to what helps them decide what time of year is it. Is it time to fly south? Is it time to fly north? Or in salmon, is it time to spawn? So it's very similar to that, except those are yearly rhythms.
Circadian clock genes affect a number of behavioral and biological processes. The importance of clock genes is becoming more evident, and disruption of circadian rhythm has been linked to disorders such as diabetes and cancer.
You know, every 6 months or so, they identify a different type of gene. So probably for about the last 15 years or so, you'll see something new come up in the literature about this new gene was discovered, and they discover it in the fruit fly, then they find it in a Syrian hamster, and then they find it in birds, and then they find it in humans. In general, you can think, okay, we have this group of rhythms that last approximately 24 hours. And what seems to be most important is that they're synchronized and they work in sync with each other. So everybody's experienced circadian desynchronization at daylight savings time. In the spring, we lose an hour and we feel pretty crappy. That's, you know, the technical term for how we feel when our circadian rhythms become desynchronized, because your sleep-wake cycle's thrown off, your body temperature cycle's thrown off, urinary excretion, everything. And so, you know, you end up waking up at weird times of night to go to the restroom, or you feel hungry at a different time. And that's just with a 1 hour disruption. Disruption of our circadian rhythms makes it very difficult for us to function. So if you work shift work, you disrupt your circadian rhythms every time you shift.
To further study disruptions in circadian rhythms, Fowler looked at sleep deprivation in military pilots and found that after 24 hours with no sleep, the pilots made critical errors in their simulation flights, colliding and crashing their planes.
So basically, after one day of being awake, your performance, your cognitive performance, is virtually the same as being legally drunk. They've been able to quantify that. There's actually a formula you can put in and say, I've been awake for this many hours. What does that equate to blood alcohol content? It's very similar to what your behavior would be. And it's very sobering when you look at what we expect of our men and women in uniform. Basically, your body needs sleep. And so you can't expect somebody to be vigilant over that long a time. And so that's how I got involved with the USTAR grant, was basically looking at how can we help maximize performance and minimize errors. And one of the things you can do is use light strategically. And light is a very, very powerful synchronizer for our circadian rhythms. It helps reset us every day.
The enlightening discovery promises to help shift workers like Rob Strupp and the FAA's air traffic controllers, whose solution to date for workers falling asleep on the job has been to terminate the sleepy ones and double up for the midnight shift. Rather, using light as a timekeeper to reset circadian rhythms and as a guide to synchronize people with their environments, there is a promising solution. The challenge is to meet individual needs.
It really depends on the person, and I think that's one of the big take-home messages, is that if a company comes in and just says, here's the lighting level, it's not going to make everybody happy. So there are ideal lighting levels that, energy-wise, and sunlight is by far the best type of light. We are organisms that have adapted to function best in sunlight. So anytime you can have natural lighting available, that's the best thing to do to wake up. Walk outside for just a second in the sun and it makes you feel better. So any type of lighting that mimics sunlight is best. You can look at light on kind of two different criteria: the level of light, the lumens, or how bright it is, and then you can also look at the color of light. And what's really interesting is that through my research, we've also found that the color of light has a very strong effect. It has a stronger effect than the intensity. So light that's in the blue-green spectrum, that's a shorter wavelength light, is actually more alerting than a longer wavelength, so the reddish light. So in our visible spectrum, it goes about 400 to 700 nanometers. Those are the wavelengths of colors that we see. Blue-green is the most alerting. So if you just slightly change the color temperature of the lighting in a room, you can decrease the intensity of the light, save on energy expenditure, but actually increase performance. And there are several studies out of Canada that have shown, I mean, especially when you look at their winters, they've shown an increase in performance in office workers in situations where you have the blue-green colors and the blue-green color light. But normally, it's very hard to look at lighting and say, oh, this is in the blue-green spectrum versus the red spectrum. If you were to put a light bulb in the blue-green versus a reddish spectrum, the blue-green would just look brighter, even if it's the same amount of energy. And that's really how we perceive it, but it would wake you up more. They actually have special sunglasses for people who work shift work, so that if you are driving home and it's daylight, they have blue-green filtering sunglasses so that you make it home and you can go to sleep, because if you shine blue-green light in somebody's eyes, they're not going to want to go to sleep when they get home. So they filter out the blue-green light, only allow the reddish-orange wavelengths to come in so that when they get home, they can fall asleep. And if you've heard of light therapy, mm-hmm. you know, for people who are depressed or seasonal affective disorder, it's almost always a blue-enriched white light that they're using. And typically it's about 10,000 lux, so they're not going to skimp on the intensity of the light. But in terms of an office setting or a work setting, you don't have to have a really high intensity if you have the right kind of light.
And task lighting, a lamp or a light near a computer, is more energy efficient and overall pleasing.
And giving people power to control their own lighting is incredibly effective. And they've actually shown that people prefer to use less light than companies would typically have in an office setting. So you can lower the ambient light, the overhead light, and give somebody a lamp, uses less overall energy, and increases satisfaction and performance. So that's what we're working on, and figuring out how to make it smart and how to make it happen automatically, so that one of the things I'm working on with Dasu is a facial recognition program, so that it, as soon as somebody turns, like I'm going to start doing something over here, the light comes on so they don't actually have to turn it on themselves. There are little cameras that you can put on light bulbs that basically what they do is they, as soon as they recognize a face, and it's not a personal, you know, like an invasion of personal space situation. It's basically, I'm looking for anything that looks like a face, and as soon as I see a face turn in this direction, this light needs to be on. So you don't have to sit there and wave or anything. It's just like, I need something off of this file cabinet. The light comes on over the file cabinet, the little task light. I get it. My face turns away. I don't need that light anymore. Because believe it or not, one of the things that's come out of some of the previous research is people prefer task lights, but they get a little upset that they have to expend the energy to reach out and turn it on and off. Because the way it's energy efficient is if you turn it off when you're not using it. And most people would just leave it on. So what we're trying to do is figure out how to get it to turn off automatically and turn on automatically, so you don't even have to do anything.
And with this technology, we may even regain control over heated or sleepy boardroom meetings with something as simple as a little cast of light.
Each person doesn't get their own lamp usually for a boardroom. But if the light is too intense, you might even think harsh, and that's typically what you'll see. You actually see changes in behavior where people might be a little bit more outspoken. Their perception of comfort is altered, and it can manifest itself in their behavior and their social interactions. You just need something that's a comforting lighting level. And so you definitely don't want it too bright and harsh, but you also don't want it too dim, which depending on the boredom level, if you're in a dim setting, you get tired. It just makes you feel sleepy, and that can have an effect on career aspirations, you know, if you fall asleep in a meeting.
Lighting affects every aspect of our lives, the way our bodies function, how we live, work, play, and heal. And artificial light technology has revolutionized societies. About 5% of the energy used in the United States is for lighting homes, buildings, and streets. According to the National Energy Education Development Project, the commercial sector uses 60% of its power for lighting. Today's office lighting systems are based on a nearly 100-year-old paradigm, and in this dated model, there's a lot of wasted energy. According to Jeff Muse, the director of the Energy Dynamics Lab, This new intuitive lighting system could significantly cut down our nation's energy consumption while also making our lives much more comfortable.
When you don't have to switch your lights on and off, when you don't have to put a sweater on, when you don't have to do anything and energy's being saved, that's when we all win. If we can save energy while maintaining the convenience and flexibility and control that people, Americans, have come to enjoy, then we will win. And in the case of the intuitive buildings or intuitive lighting, you know, some of their estimates are that we could replace a couple of power plants if we were to instrument all the buildings in the United States with this technology. So I think the impact could be very large.
The EDL team hopes their new lights will cut energy use by more than half of what we use by 2015. It is long past 1984, and Orwellian or not, this intuitive lighting technology is already up and running in the EDL office spaces, where the rooms are getting to know their humans well, anticipating their next moves and tuned into their circadian rhythms, streaming vital blue-green rays on otherwise laggard afternoons, illuminating boardroom discussions and then dimming to an intimate and energy-saving task light when the human moves to her desk for some quiet work on her computer. This is the future.
Essentially, we're trying to understand human behavior from a software and hardware perspective, so that it can be of use in elderly care. It can be of use in retail segment. We are developing the ability to figure out what products in a shelf interest the customer. We could tell what brand of cereal the shopper's looking at and which one caught more attention, which one did they look at for prolonged periods of time but still didn't end up buying it. So there's something wrong with the pricing, you know, things of that nature. And tracking such patterns can be sent, for instance, to sales associates in a store to suggest that, okay, this person liked this combination of dress. She's been looking at that purse for a while. So here's the suggestions on how to improve the dynamics in the store. It can also be used for security purposes. For instance, in airports, is somebody looking at some specific parts of the airport often and suspiciously? So without being intrusive, there's a suite of technologies that we're working on for different market segments.
The Energy Dynamics Lab is also working on technologies where all of these applications are easily accessible and highly networked.
We think that these sensors are going to be so cheap that they'll be installed everywhere. Then we'll run into the issue of collecting large amounts of data. And somebody wants to do something clever with the data. So like the stock analyst, for example, they have tons of data and run statistical algorithms to correlate this stock versus that event and so on. So we think that such kind of rich visualization tools are needed for back-end people to know maybe what's the traffic pattern, what's the shopping habits, what's the energy consumption, and things of that nature. So it's like a virtual reality walk-in visualization room. You step in, the walls, the ceiling, everything represents data of some form or the other. Time, location, habits, etc. So you can zoom in, zoom out to whatever level you want and tie it with back-end statistical correlation algorithms that will help extract intelligent info out of this. It's a lot of work.
Thank you for listening. This show is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery. For more information, visit sqradio.org.